Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Burlingham Barrett on Crime. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my good friend, Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hey, Simon, how are you?
I'm doing fine. And by the way, happy birthday, or... it's belated, I think.
Well, no, you sent me one on time, and I appreciate it. I'm actually enjoying this birthday, something that men my age don't generally do.
Yeah, I gave up counting mine a while back.
God, you know, and I'm sure my other guests will agree, there's always somebody, and you always have a friend who remind you, and I have one that finds the ugliest, meanest cards you've ever seen in your life. You just start with, like, you old fart, you know, that kind of stuff, and John can figure out very quickly who it is, and he bombs me with them every year.
Perfect. I have to admit that I have studiously tried to keep out of the whole Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman saga. In my humble opinion, it's just an ugly mess, short on facts, but very long on rhetoric. Well, this week, Manny and I are going to delve into this mess. Manny, you brought along a guest. Would you
I sure did, and
intro?
I'm loaded for bear today. One of our guests is John Perry, the founder of Sunset Protections, a former L.A. County Sheriff's Detective who really knows the ropes on violence, worked in South Los Angeles area in his career, and really understands what goes on in those neighborhoods. And John, welcome to the show, and we're just going to get right into it in a minute, but how are you doing?
Glad to be here, Manny, and I want to forewarn you, I had my pregame meal of nitrates, phosphates, and carcinogens, and I'm ready for you.
Oh, Lord. And I didn't want to be outgunned, so I've brought along my own guest, L.A.-based attorney and very sharp-brained guy, Peter Haven. Peter, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's very good to be here. I wasn't sure who you were talking about when you said sharp-brained guy, but I'm happy to contribute any way I can.
See, he thought you said sharp-dressed man, but that's a little different, right?
A little bit different.
I'd rather have a sharp brain than a sharp dress.
Ooh, I don't know.
Simon, I saw your picture on the internet, and you definitely have the wardrobe for radio.
John, I would have paid you to say that.
Oh, I can just tell this is going to be a great program.
So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. You know, to give a little background, we're gonna get into a slightly different viewpoint of Trayvon Martin. And it's the battle in the media. And the battle that we see going on is a battle between Fox and CNN. And in some instances, we have MSNBC dragged into this wonderful little mess. And I don't know if it's going to call it the battle of the spins, the battle of the lack of spins or what, but it's getting interesting. So there's as much name-calling going on in that arena as there is in the various court cases. So I don't know where to jump in, Simon. I guess it's probably a good idea for you to jump in, but wait a minute. First, I think I should mention one thing. This is sort of a liberal versus a conservative viewpoint, which I personally find strange because both of them, to me, are conservative. Yes, Time Warner was founded by Ted Turner, and people make a big thing about that, but Ted Turner has not been on the board at Time Warner for a number of years because, in many respects, his views were too liberal, and nobody wanted him on the board, and nobody would listen to him. So he's long gone, but it's owned by Warner Brothers, which is a very, very conservative company that would be listed primarily as a Republican-based company. And then you've got, you know, Fox News is founded by Rupert Murdoch, famed for News of the World, which is one of Simon's favorites. And so here we have, you know, people from two different backgrounds, but yet in many respects they're the same. And yet when it comes to this case, they're rendering viewpoints that are so severely different than what they generally say in public or what their images are. So this makes the battle even more interesting to me, is why are they battling over this? What is the purpose of it? So, Simon, jump in. Where do you want to go?
Okay. My view is MSNBC very much on the left of this story. They're right behind the, Trayvon Martin side of the house. We have Fox News there to the right, and they're very much in the George Zimmerman corner, marginally right wing of Attila the Hun. Then you've got CNN. I don't particularly like CNN. I think that since Ted left, they've kind of gone to the dogs, but they do sit left of center. Let me give you an example of spin that's going on right now. Fox News came out with a story, and it concerns the head of the Southern Baptist Convention's public policy arm, whatever the hell that is, condemning the response that many black leaders are acting in a shameful manner. Oh, come on. I mean, this is spin, spin, spin. I mean, yes, I agree. The Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons of the world should just keep their noses out of it. But I think that Fox News should keep their nose out of it as well. Yeah, all they're doing is encouraging the story. That's not reporting the news. It's just perpetuating a problem. Okay, I'll shut up now.
Well, John, let's go to John for a moment. You have strong feelings about Fox News. I think that's the only thing you watch, right?
And sports, sure.
Well, I'm in terms of news.
Every other station insults my intelligence.
Well, we know which side of the fence you're on.
But so, I disagree with Simon that Fox has a position on this. Certainly, there's different opinions, but from what I've heard, and I probably watch it more than you guys combined, their basic position of the commentators is, let's wait for the facts and see what happens. They're not calling for any conclusion.
Ooh. Peter, I have no clue what your news preference is, so I'd be interested to get your comment about these three companies.
My news preference tends to be avoided until it's absolutely unavoidable, and then try to pay attention to it. And I don't really follow any of the major news networks all that carefully. We did have a lot of work with Murdoch and Fox back in the days when I was working on the Goldman case in connection with the If I Did It book. But, you know, I can't help but feel that there has been from all corners, a lot of commentary and expressions of opinions regarding what happened here. And I myself find that I really don't know a lot of the actual facts underlying the case, whether they be alleged or otherwise. I tend to be pretty neutral when it comes to looking at the news. I really kind of want to figure out what happened. And I only know a smattering of the facts as they've been related. And, I do look forward to seeing those get addressed a little bit in greater detail if this matter goes to trial.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying the facts are more important? Oh, my goodness.
No, not more important. Just to simpletons like me who can't really grasp bigger pictures, the facts are the only thing I could get my head around.
Oh, you're not willing to make any up. Well, okay. I just want to make sure now.
I've tried that.
I agree with you.
It doesn't work so well, but I've tried.
Well, I think that you're advancing a classic lawyer's view, including mine, which is that sooner or later the truth comes out. But along this road has been this really unusual addition of all these different statements and facts and beliefs. And because so little has been said and so little is discovered, it allows the media to wander sort of like a coffee clutch, you know, in a gossip club. So my view of both stations, and believe it or not, John, I've made some attempts to listen to Fox. I admit I had to hold my nose a couple of times, but I did get past it. And I just feel like they're just gossiping. And basically I believe that CNN, excuse me, is guilty of the same. What do you think?
You asking me?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I have seen a couple of excerpts from CNN, which was total exploitation of the incident, and even some members of Congress. Roland Martin, no relation to CNN commentator, was on a program wearing a hoodie. Bobby Rush wearing a hoodie. CNN, who's a congressman from Chicago, I believe. CNN also put on this clown who claimed to be a voice enhancement analyst, saying he could determine from a 911 tape that the word coon was used. And it turned out it was cold. The term cold was used. So everybody except Fox seems to have an agenda. They echo what you were saying earlier, Peter. Let's wait for the facts to come out. And I would like to say one of the reasons this is so prominent in the news is it reminds me of a quote of Joseph Stalin, who would liquidate thousands of people with the stroke of a pen. He said, "One death is a tragedy, 1,000 deaths are a statistic." This fatal encounter has been elevated to the level of tragedy, and the thousands of other people who have died since then, they're just a statistic. So ask yourself, why is that? Obviously, people have an agenda.
Oh, and I don't think there's any doubt that there's an agenda. But you said something incredibly interesting, and it's been bothering me. This whole hoodie business, that there's a gentleman, I use the term loosely, Steph Watts, man with the nose for news. He got fired from, I think it was NBC, for getting a nose job and putting it on his corporate credit card. But he suddenly popped up on Facebook, and his picture has him wearing a hoodie, which there is no way he would ever wear one under normal circumstances. I mean, why are we so hung up on this hoodie business?
Well, let me jump into this, because I just read an article by an author in Milwaukee who opines that this is one of the major issues with this, is hoodies and the fact that they're so popular in the black community that they're creating an image. And CNN had a professor from Vanderbilt University who opined that that basically young black men need to get away from this image because it's a disturbing image in society, and that in many respects they're rebelling against society. And my observation about hoodies is, if hoodies are so bad, and in this particular case, if you want to say someone who's targeted because they're wearing a hoodie, it raises questions, because the biggest hoodie of all is Bill Belichick, and I don't see anybody chasing him down as a suspicious character, although I, as a football fan, I've always considered him a suspicious character.
Peter, do you think that this hoodie business has just gone on too long, gone too far?
It probably was before this incident. It's becoming a kind of symbol. And after the incident, the symbol has now been crystallized. We have the image of Trayvon Martin in the hoodie. We also have, you know, the Miami Heat posing in hoodies. It's become a symbol for this incident, and this incident, to me, at the core of it, is obviously, you know, race relations. And I keep hearkening back to things in the Simpson versus Goldman case because I was, you know, I was here for all of that. And the Simpson the Simpson criminal trial was about race relations. And what became the subject matter of the trial was, you know, an effort to portray how police and authoritarian figures treated African Americans. And that's what the criminal trial was primarily about. And that is what this case is becoming about. And that is what the rallying cry has become about. And, you know, I'm not an expert on why young men like to wear hoodies, but it does seem to me that they are, you know, if they're walking around with their hoods over their heads, they are expressing themselves, making some type of statement. They certainly don't deserve to be shot for it, but, you know, they are making a kind of statement of some type. And I guess this is an example of what happens when it can go too far, but I'm still searching to struggle for some of the facts of the case, but it does seem to me, obviously, that this hoodie is now a symbol for race relations and the theme that's going to present itself in Florida if this matter continues through trial.
You know, I really have got to jump in about O.J. Simpson because, Peter, I have rarely disagreed with you, but I really disagree with you on that. A friend of mine, Bert Katz, former Judge Katz, who was a mentor of mine, was a witness in the case, and through the entire case, I told him Simpson would be found not guilty. And he said, well, it's because it's a race issue, and I kept saying to him, no. The issue in this case is the LAPD, and it's still an issue, has long held an image created by too many people watching too many Dragnet, SWAT, and other related TV shows, and the LAPD for years has had this bloated image of being this super cool police department that gets its man every time, where those of us who live there and have any, or live in Los Angeles, have any involvement with them, will tell you quite the contrary. Now, John spent a lot of time in the sheriff's department, and I know for a fact because my best friend, who John knows, was also a lieutenant of the sheriff's department in the reserves, and I know how little respect the sheriff's department has for the LAPD, which adds to it even further. So part of that was the belief that they bungled the case from the beginning and just made it worse day after day. And their handling of the evidence, the handling of the issues, the rush to do it, the mistake by the DA to have the matter moved to downtown Los Angeles so he could, you know, personally attend every press conference because he didn't want to drive to Santa Monica, were all issues that caused Simpson to be found not guilty. And I think it had less to do with some of the issues that you're discussing. But that gets us right back to this case. That's one of the issues in this case, is everybody, because the facts aren't clear and not enough of it has gotten in the press, are in a position to speculate according to their prejudice. So if they have a liberal bias, they make liberal, you know, suggestions. And if they're on the more conservative bias, you know, in the case of Fox, where I disagree with John, yes, they withheld comment, but very slyly. There have been every kind of character assassination, and in some cases their comments to me border on being racist, John. Now, you want to defend Fox, because I know you do every time we have lunch, jump in.
Well, I don't feel it's necessary. I obviously strongly disagree with your characterization, but I think you accidentally did stumble onto a good point about Bill Belichick. We've learned he's no slave to fashion, and he wore that hoodie for practical purposes. There's no reason to wear it in the summer at 2 in the afternoon. Obviously, people are making a fashion statement with it.
Okay. Well, there's no question that it has become a symbol of not just black youth, but youth across America, period.
And as far as George Zimmerman, I'm really not accustomed to defending Democrats, but if you want, I'll give it a shot. But I don't know the facts, and it's difficult, but I have read some of the arrest affidavit, and even Alan Dershowitz says the elements of the crime aren't even in it. It's a very flimsy document, and That's why they didn't go to a grand jury, because they probably wouldn't have even decided to charge him.
Well, okay. I agree with that. Go ahead.
And that's why Angela Corey took it upon herself, because she's an elected official, and she's got to run for office and appease the public. So everything about this case is political, except, Manny, which you mentioned, Bill Belichick.
Everything's political. But let me give you my perspective on hoodies. I don't want to spend an hour on it. I'm 56 years old. I'm about 140 pounds dripping wet. And if I'm out walking at night and I see someone, you know, color, shall we say, and I'm not racist, you know, wearing a hoodie, yeah, I'm somewhat leery. I wouldn't wear a hoodie into my local bank, for example. Where's the reason for having the hood over your head when it's not raining, the weather's nice? Someone explain that bit to me.
I think we've
touched upon it, and it's a bit of a fashion statement. You know, I'm not quite sure what the statement is, but it's a statement of, you know, a look and appearance. And I think at its basic level, it basically says, you know, I'm no softy. You know, don't push me around. I'm not an easy guy to mess around with. At a minimum, I think when there's no other reason for it, putting the hood over your head broadcasts that kind of symbol. You know, I have to be careful. But when I there's a video game that I see advertised on television all the time, and it's called Master of Assassins. And you know, I've never played the game. I don't know anything about the game, but I see the videos of the game all the time. It's always on, you know, sporting shows that I watch and things like that. And it's a picture of a guy with a hoodie. And, you know, you can look it up now. I mean, it seems to me that there's a kind of a mystique that goes around wearing that and having that look. Now, it probably 99% of the time, that's all it is. But it does have the effect of creating the mystique, as Simon described. I mean, you know, when you see someone coming down the street with a hoodie over their head, it has the effect of putting you on your guard, even if that's all it does. It just puts you on your guard. And I agree with what Manny said about Bill Belichick. You know, he's not wearing it as a fashion statement. Half the time he doesn't even have the hood over his head unless it's raining. You know, that's just a guy who clearly puts on clothes just to be comfortable. And, you know, probably looks good on him. If he was wearing anything else, he wouldn't look so good. I don't really know what else to say about that. I'm so unknowledgeable about why this form of fashion has arisen, but I do know that it has an effect. And sometimes if you want to understand the purpose of something, you consider the effect. And the effect is, as you described, Simon, it says I'm not somebody to be messed with, or I'm tough, or what have you. Fill in the blank.
Right. I could ask John the same question, but, you know, John runs a security business. I'm sure he's not particularly scared. But, you know, for us regular little guys, I do get scared. Manny, I doubt that you would care to meet someone in the dark of night wearing one.
Well, I don't want to meet anybody in the dark of night, first of all. But, no, you know, first of all, the hoodies go back to the rappers. They were the ones who started wearing hoodies, and they're the ones who brought this I know. Guys like LL Cool J, who's now living a normal life doing NCIS Los Angeles, wasn't always doing normal work, and he was one of the fathers of rap music, and I believe that that's where it emanates. So a lot of these guys are emulating rappers who may not be popular within the mainstream. So I think that stigma comes into bear, too, that who they've chosen to identify with are not people the general public would like to see them identify with. And I think that's a stigma that goes with it.
John, do you want to leap in and explain that you don't believe any of this and hoodies are okay?
I don't have a problem with hoodies, but it just goes to street cred. 90% of people wearing hoodies are just trying to fit in and are insecure about their appearance. It's the same way with baggy pants, boxers hanging out, tattoos. They want to present this image that probably a lot of them don't deserve, and they feel like they're going to get respect on the street by dressing a certain way. But no, and actually that's one of the elements of this arrest affidavit, that the prosecutor's claiming George Zimmerman profiled Trayvon Martin because he was wearing a hoodie.
Yes,
which is ridiculous, but that's what's in there. But also, too, a lot of crimes are committed by people wearing hoodies because it does conceal their face somewhat, you know, and it is a kind of a 211 or robbery outfit.
Oh, absolutely, John.
But 99% of the people wearing hoodies aren't going to commit robberies. But when you see a tape of a convenience store or jewelry store robbery, very good chance the perpetrator is going to be wearing a hoodie.
John, when you say it's ridiculous to profile based on the hoodie, could you just tell me exactly what you mean by that? Because it sounds to me
there are elements, Peter, in this, that it's a gated community. Probably elderly people live there. I don't know. And he just looked out of place walking around. He's obviously not 55 or over.
Right, sure.
And I don't know how he was walking. It could have been aimlessly. Maybe he didn't know where he was going. And this guy's working neighborhood watch. He's going to be probably overzealous. A lot of them are. They're out there. They want to show the people that they're making a positive contribution. And they're going to call on every little thing.
Yeah.
A lot of them, just for the attention of it. And I don't know if Zimmerman was like that, but a lot of people are in that position. They want to let people know, I'm out here looking out for you. And really, the only way they can do that is call the police, and then they're seen.
Well,
exactly.
His motives. But he felt, for whatever reason, the kid was out of place, and he did probably what he's done dozens of times before and make a call. And I don't see how you can justify a second-degree murder under those circumstances, that considering he made the call to the police, how many people are going to have a thought in their mind, I'm going to fatally engage this person, but first I'm going to call the police? It makes no sense. And I haven't heard that articulated.
That's
a
good point.
John, let me disagree with you one concept about murder, okay? One of the issues with murder and second-degree murder isn't so much that. It's the lack of premeditation. But he's still going in with a bad heart and a bad spirit and with a sense of malice, but not,
Legal term, and he's depraved mind.
Well, that's another variation of it, too. But that's only part of it. I want to come back to something you said earlier when you start talking about this. You know, basically speaking, you've got a closed community and you have a security guard. You know, I've been in the security guard business for years. I represented a variety of security companies earlier in my career, and as John knows, I have a lot of experience in it. And there's certain guys who are cop wannabes who can't make the grade in the police department that carry within them this attitude, and the bottom line is they could not pass a test to be in a police department because of the same type of mental problems that lead to people getting shot under these circumstances. And that's why security card companies have so many problems with their employees. And you've seen it throughout your career, John. You struggle not, you make sure you don't hire these people.
Absolutely. That's why they're overzealous, which I said. They have, think they have something to prove.
Right, and I think that's a big problem when we all measure these issues. Is that a case, and is that a predisposition of Zimmerman's? And I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but that has to be measured. And that predisposition could raise someone to view it as a second-degree murder. But I happen to agree with you. I don't see second-degree murder as appropriate because it's too hard to prove the mental state necessary for it. And Peter, I would ask you the same question. Don't you think it's extremely difficult to prove the mental state necessary for second-degree murder and this basic fact situation, at least the one we're aware of?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, just for the benefit of our listeners, I think of second-degree murder as you get in a car and you go drag racing down a crowded street. You don't specifically intend to kill anyone, but you are fairly certain, if not certain, that what you're going to do is end up killing people in the process. So I would agree with you, Manny, that it's going to be very hard to prove second-degree murder, but maybe that's the whole point. Maybe the prosecutors feel pressure to put this case on trial, and maybe, and I'm really speculating now, they don't really want a conviction, but they want the whole thing to unfold.
That's occurred to me also, but that goes back to even the O.J. Simpson case, because every one of these cases where that's true, there's some agenda in the case, and there was clearly an agenda in the O.J. Simpson case from day one. And that's one reason why they rushed to arrest him, is because they felt pressured to.
They felt pressured to, but, you know, they clearly had two murder victims, and they had a guy fleeing or apparently fleeing. So to a certain extent, I agree with you. There is tremendous public pressure to bring these cases on the prosecutor's office, and we've seen this many times. Obviously, there's tremendous pressure in a high-profile case like Simpson. I keep thinking of another case that Al Sharpton was involved with not too long ago, which people may have forgotten, but I think of the Duke rape case scandal, and I remember Sharpton being involved with that, and there was tremendous pressure to bring a prosecution in that case. I think about, obviously, the pressure to bring the Kobe Bryant case in Colorado. And now we've got, you know, another in a long line, and these are only a few examples. This happens all the time, and it's not to say there's anything wrong with it, but obviously the community is severely divided, as evidenced by the fact that our national media are severely divided, and the prosecutors they can't just deal with this as they might ordinarily deal with a low profile case. And it also dovetails a little bit into what you talked a lot about, Manny. I agreed with you regarding the assessment of a lot of what the LAPD did, because a lot of what the LAPD did and everybody does is most of the times they prosecute and they don't have to face scrutiny. And under any of those circumstances, you get sloppy. And they were very sloppy. There's no doubt about that. And every now and then, one of these cases comes down the pike, and everybody is forced to basically put the system back on the microscope, shine the spotlights back on the system, and examine once again, have we become too sloppy? What's happening here? What's going on? And you know, here's the latest version of that, and apparently it's all going to unfold in Florida, and we're going to find out once again you know, what's right and what's wrong about the various systems at work.
Right, well, and I want to add something before you jump in on that, Simon, is, yeah, one of the other issues that gets lost, is, and it's more true of the Duke case, is the interest of a particular prosecutor to improve himself in terms of being able to run for office.
Absolutely.
And that is a factor that jumps in, and frankly, We saw that with the McMartin murder trial. We always felt that that was a contributing factor to that debacle also. And in regard to Simpson and that, you know, we all have to deal with the fact that sometimes the district attorney's office in Los Angeles is too affected by political pressure and too motivated by other factors. I mean, I could list them all day, and so can you, and I'm not going to bore our audience with the dissatisfaction felt by lawyers with what goes on in our system in Los Angeles, but it is just too political. And it is becoming more and more true with the advent of the larger press, because now more of these guys are getting on TV. So every time this issue comes up, I see some guy mugging for the TV, which gets me to the next one. How about the guys who just could not leave their client gracefully and move on to another, you know, another potential case, and had to call a press conference to talk about why they were no longer going to represent Trayvon Martin, where they didn't even have a fee agreement signed with the guy.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I'll tell you over and over again.
Let's come back to that. I want to go out to the phone lines, which is always scary. We have someone coming in from, I think it's probably Idaho, area code 208. What's your name, and what's your question for us?
Oh, it's your local resident from Boise, Idaho. You're right. Common sense from Idaho, Simon. You guys just keep provoking me.
That's our favorite thing to do. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Just wonderful. We took Easter off, so I don't know what you could possibly do without us on Easter. How did you survive?
I know. I was totally lost. I was really ticked off that Easter had to fall on a Sunday. Anyway, I just have a question about the level of responsibility. One of your guests had commented on taking a street rod out and racing it and the second-degree murder conversation that you were having. And, you know, I'm not going to be the one that decides, you know, who's guilty, who's not, whatever. I'm just sort of watching at this thing from afar and seeing kind of how I feel about the whole thing is that he had a level of responsibility, just like taking a street rod out into public and racing by carrying a concealed weapon. Is that true? I mean, when you get a concealed weapons permit, aren't you taking on the responsibility of using that in a responsible manner? I mean, that's my question, and I'm not exactly sure who can answer it there.
I don't think anybody, this is Peter Haven, by the way, I don't think anybody would ever disagree with what you're suggesting, which is that if you have, if you take the responsibility for carrying a weapon, quite frankly, concealed or otherwise, permitted or otherwise, you have a responsibility to do so in a responsible and reasonable manner. And that's what this whole case is ultimately going to be about. It's going to be, was he justified or excused in using deadly force to defend himself from the threat of deadly force or serious bodily harm? Because if that is the finding, then the use of the firearm was reasonable, it was either justified or excused, and if not, then it's not. And there are several ways to look at it, but the short answer to your question is you're absolutely correct. That's going to be what the whole case is about.
But would that rise to the level of second-degree murder just in the fact that he was carrying a weapon? I mean,
well, I think the real battleground over the murder of the murder charge is not going to be the charge itself. It's going to be the defense, because the defense is going to be, if I understand correctly, self-defense. And again, you know, I just did one of these trials 2 years ago, and it will be incumbent upon the defense to put forth sufficient evidence to show that this was, in fact, self-defense. And that that will be, in my opinion, based upon what little factual information I have, how it plays out in front of the jury.
Hmm.
Well, let's get to the next phase. We're talking about a jurisdiction with a notoriously strange twist on the law. And, you know, I, from time to time, comment that laws are uniquely different in both Texas and in Florida. And what we're seeing is that difference is because in most states, particularly ones that don't have this law, this wouldn't even be an issue, would it?
Right.
So,
yeah, that's a really strange, you know, stand your ground and then you go out and with a concealed weapon. You know, that whole thing just doesn't make sense to all the rest of the nation. I mean, we're all scratching our heads saying, okay, well, how can you be out walking around in public and stand your ground? That's a little unusual, but I guess it depends on how the facts are, you know, given and what they are. I mean, nobody knows, and I'm glad to see that somebody has some common sense. And I'm looking at the prosecutors and thinking that they probably brought this case just to take down the level of outrage that was out there, and good for them. I think that was a good decision, no matter how it plays out. I mean, somebody needed to look at it and say, okay, what are the facts here? Because there was so much out there that wasn't even fact. I mean, people were speculating about this and that, and I'm just glad that somebody's going to look into what the heck happened, because it doesn't seem that the police force, at least to me, did anything about trying to figure out what exactly went on that night. And I don't know, that's just my opinion. I don't know what everybody else's is. I choose not to talk about this in a public forum.
You've brought up a very important question. But the whole stand your ground law, I believe that it's basically in existence in some form or another in about half the states. But as I understand it, and I'm not the legal guys, yeah, so Manny and Peter, you're going to have to field this. You can't go out and be the aggressor and then turn around and claim stand your ground self-defense.
Well, that's one of the points to all of this is, in this particular case, the question is if Zimmerman initiated contact, which everybody seems to agree he did, that much we all agree on, based upon what was said on the phone to the police.
I'm not certain of that, Manny.
Well, it seems to be pretty clear when he called the police, they told him not to have any involvement with this particular individual, and he did anyway. So the fact is that he initiated contact, John. I mean, how can you say otherwise?
Because there's time lapse. We don't know who contacted whom.
Well, have you listened to the tracking of? Well, first of all, his telephone records indicate that he was on the telephone right up to and including the event, which means that it's pretty hard. And plus, he was on the phone with his girlfriend.
Manny, I don't understand. It's been claimed that he thought Zimmerman was following him. Instead of calling his girlfriend, why wouldn't he call the police?
Oh, because he's black, and black men don't call the police. You know that. Have you ever, come on, you know, you really think he was going to call the police thinking he would get any help from them?
I guess I give him more credit as far as being an independent thinker. I don't know, Manny.
Well, let me raise a question, because no one said this to him, and I don't know if I'm the only person who's ever been in Sanford, Florida, or not, but it's not a community that I would suspect anybody would have this level of security issues with. So I wonder why there's a neighborhood watch guy in the first place there. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with Florida, it's a very small town on the road between Orlando and Daytona Beach. Been there dozens of times. My my father-in-law has passed away, so I've made more than one trip there to, you know, pay tribute to him. And sorry, that's a bad way to refer to your father-in-law. But the fact remains that I've driven through that area an awful lot, and I don't even see any level of unrest that would spark any kind of.
Hey, hadn't you heard there were several reports of burglaries in the area?
Well, yeah, but that burglaries aren't violent acts.
They could be.
The burglaries are only violent acts when people are confronted, and then it doesn't become a burglary anymore, and it doesn't show up in the stats as a burglary.
But even if you want to say it's nonviolent, that's a reason to patrol your community.
Oh, okay. All right. This patrolling
if I could just jump in real quick.
I mean, just because, you know, you're looking after your neighbors, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. But I keep hearing that this was a gated community. So how did the kid get in there in the first place?
I think his father lived there.
No, he was the facts are that he was within, I don't know, it was 100 feet of his father's place. That's what he was doing there, Simon. He was with his father, seeing his
father. I think his father resided in the community.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of answers my question. You know, gated community should be safe. Yeah, if you go out walking around, you see someone wearing a hoodie, you go, wow, strange, but hey, we're safe.
Simon, believe it or not, crime's committed in gated communities.
You know, one of the interesting concepts about a gated community is, you know, the Stand Your Ground laws, as I understand them, derive from the basic doctrine that allows people within the confines of their home to basically use deadly force. In other words, the concept of using deadly force arises, you know, or it's connected to a doctrine called the duty to retreat. In other words, you can use deadly force if that's your only option. And in many places, there's a duty to leave, get out of the way, try to avoid this. And if you truly can't avoid it, then that bolsters your defense that you use self-defense. The concept of retreat does not apply in one's home. Under most jurisdictions, I believe all jurisdictions. In other words, if you find an intruder in your home, that's prima facie evidence of a threat. That's prima facie evidence that they're there for the wrong purpose. And you, in most places, are entitled to use deadly force. And what we're dealing with here is a gray zone, because a gated community can be seen as a large home. But obviously, it's not a large home. There are public areas which, you know, are not the same as being inside the four walls of your home. So, you know, I'm just painting a picture here that this is just a hazy gray area.
I don't agree with you, Peter, in this regard. Okay, what I don't agree is that, first of all, a home is a home. And under any circumstances, Zimmerman did not live there, did not live under the color of authority that goes with protecting your own home. And in many respects, I don't think those actions apply to him. And that's one of my problems with the laws in Florida. This law, everybody was in such a hurry to pass it, they really didn't think about the consequences of what they were doing, and they didn't really accurately spell it out. So to a great extent, their laws really untested in this area. There, for the record, there's about been 132 incidents of standalone in Florida, and I believe 87 of them were convicted of murder or some varying homicide would be a more accurate one. I've never seen a stat on exactly what the percentages are. So they've been confronted with this for some time, and yet they haven't done anything to clarify the law, shore it up, or do anything. So in many respects, this is a problem of a legislature that really didn't do their work well.
Yeah, that's. I agree with all of that. I think it's a troublesome law in and of itself. It also leads me to wonder if there's going to be a motion to try to transfer venue for this trial to some other area or perhaps even some other state. And somehow I doubt that motion will be successful, even though it should probably be very seriously considered.
Well, no, I listen to Mary. He is seriously considering if it needs to see more facts developed. And the simple fact is, you and I know, you've got to make a motion when it's ripe, and I don't think it's ripe for him to make that kind of commitment, because he more than likely would lose at this phase because he doesn't have enough information. Plus, he's not even sure he has a judge.
Yeah.
So that adds to it also. And I don't believe that you can move a case to another state, maybe a federal case, but I don't believe a state case can be relocated, do you?
Well, I actually thought you were correct, but I've heard people discussing the possibility of moving it outside the state, and I agree with you. I would think that it could be moved to another venue within the state, but I didn't think it could be transferred out of the form altogether. But I have heard people talking about a motion to have it transferred completely out of the state.
I thought they really didn't know the law or understand it when they made that statement, because they weren't lawyers that I'd listened to, and I found myself saying to myself, kind of chuckling, that you guys don't have a clue.
You're not in the same jurisdiction anymore, so I don't know how that would work.
You would have to interpret the law different. The cost the state of Florida have to bivouac their prosecutors in another area. I mean, you add it all up, and it just smells of problems. But coming back to the base of Sanford, Florida, I think it's also safe to say that it may be a very, very good jurisdiction for Zimmerman, because more than likely he's going to get a primarily white jury, and they're going to be probably very sympathetic to those issues. I don't see a situation where the jurors are, you know, much like the mistake of the Simpson trial, as you well know, is moving it to downtown Los Angeles, where, you know, basically he got a different jury pool than he would have gotten Santa Monica.
Yep.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen where the case is presently. It doesn't seem to be a problem in that county.
Well, you know, everything after the post-Rodney King, post-Simpson world is looked at a little bit differently, and I don't know to what extent that people in Florida are worried at all about riots and future civil unrest. But people may think about that in deciding this issue, but I suspect you're probably right. At the end of the day, the defense won't want to change the venue if the jury pool is going to be as you described.
Yeah, well, the whole reason to stand your ground law in Florida is so this could start riots and everybody could stand their ground and be a shooting match. Because there's a certain once you get away from Miami, the more liberal part of Miami, then you know, everybody in that state is a little gun-oriented, NRA-oriented, and probably wouldn't mind that.
Yeah.
You know, did you see the article on the soldier who was called to task out in Palmdale at the Marine base for making a tweet that I'm going shooting all black today like Zimmerman?
All right.
So, you know, this just raises ups the ante on the issue too, right?
I didn't hear about that, but I've heard about an incredible number of just insane comments made on Twitter, social media. I even saw a picture of a traffic sign somewhere that somebody had doctored the traffic sign to basically make a very disparaging remark about all this, and I was just astounded. This is going to be a real lightning rod. And, you know, people in the jurisdiction where this is going to unfold have to be certainly prepared for that.
Oh, I think they are. And, I mean, to me, that was one of the points of the Simpson case, and this case, too, is it's bringing out, up to the surface, the underlying discord about racial incidents in the United States, and it's enabling the Sharptons and the rest of these guys in the world to start taking these positions that a lot of people find just really onerous, right, John?
I'll tell you what. Let's leap out to the phone lines. We have someone calling in from Indianapolis, I think. Hello, caller.
How are you guys doing today?
Great.
Well, here's a couple things I want to bring up about this Zimmerman case. Now, this guy was arrested. He had a domestic battery incident with a girlfriend. He was also arrested for a skirmish with police. He was charged with resisting law enforcement with violence. He pled to a lesser charge of resisting law enforcement without violence. It was a plea bargain deal. My concern here is everybody's making this a race issue when, in fact, we should be looking at it being a gun issue. Is why would anybody with this guy's previous past issue him a gun permit? I mean, do you already see it come across your... I mean, if you guys are sitting there with this guy's gun permit request coming across your desk, why would you sign off on that and say, well, he's beat the tar out of a law enforcement officer, okay, he pled out. Why do we have it in the gun laws in Florida that after X amount of years, they now look at that as saying, well, that's okay, that's in the past, here you go, here's your gun permit, giving him now even more weaponry to use possibly against law enforcement or, in this case, this young teenager. I mean, to me, Florida is somewhat, you know, in liability or whatever you want to say in their disregard for just common sense when it comes to issuing gun permits.
You won't get any argument from me. Well, that's one of the problems with these jurisdictions. I believe the same thing would occur in Texas because
and,
that
you know,
is the policy.
And, you know, the thing of it is, I'm a gun rights advocate. I think anybody should have a right to carry a weapon. But to simply start issuing permits because you slap down $5 or $50 or whatever it is in your state, they do a simple background check, bingo, bango, yeah, you've had some problems here in the past, some conflicts with law enforcement. That in itself should, you know, you should totally be banned from ever having a gun permit. I'm not saying you can't go out and buy a gun, protect yourself in your home, but you shouldn't be able to walk the streets with it.
Well,
those are very good points. Yeah, they're very good points. And I think that's going to be explored when the civil lawsuits coming out of this case start to percolate. And I think those lawsuits are going to wait to see how a lot of the criminal proceeding unfolds. But I foresee the civil lawsuit getting into precisely these issues.
And now, and another thing I wanted to say, and I heard this on another show, and it kind of got me thinking. You know, I'm a middle-aged white man, and, you know, we can play this anyway. If a white guy is walking down the street and a white man walks up behind him and shoots him, okay, the white community ourselves, we look at that and go, wow, that's bad. That's shameful. Sorry to hear that happen. Black man walks up behind a black man, shoots him. Black community goes, that's bad, I wish that wouldn't have happened. But when we cross the racial line and a black man shoots a white man, the white community is up in arms, and vice versa. If a white man walks up to a black man, the black community's up in arms. The problem I see is whites are basically, you know, tolerant to some degree when it comes to white-on-white violence. Blacks are tolerant when it comes to black-on-black violence. We see that in the inner city, okay? The problem of it is we all need to clean up our own neighborhoods, and we should be alarmed about all crime, just not when it crosses the racial line, which is, you know, obviously bad. But, I mean, I think that's the point. I mean, and I don't mean this the way it sounds, but why should I care that George Zimmerman killed this young teen when, in fact, blacks in their own community, and on the other hand, whites in their own community, don't care about their own race-on-race crimes?
This is something that's been raised by a great many people, and I also continually bring up, too. And knowing Indianapolis as I do, you have your own share of unusual problems there. And
yep.
And it is difficult, and I say that because I'm sure this will ring a bell. Melvin Simon was, until his death, one of my closest friends, and I represented Mel as well as the Pacers and others, and I'm sure living there you know exactly who I'm talking about.
Yeah, yes,
so I've spent a lot of time there in Indianapolis, and Brent Simon's still one of my closest friends, and I go back and forth with it. And I'm amazed, as the black community has increased throughout these various cities, problems have increased exponentially with not only, but primarily in the black and black crime, which I consider an issue of poverty, and that's something that gets lost in all of this, is a lot
right.
of this are poverty issue areas, but not, it appears to be true in this particular case, because I have not seen anything to indicate that Trayvon Martin's family are in any way in poor financial shape. I haven't seen anything to indicate this was a bad kid. I look at his photos, I see the smile on his face, and I don't see that gangsta look, that attitude, and the rest of it, and that makes it even more interesting. And
well,
I've
seen both pictures. I've seen him as a young, smiling kid. I've also seen some that someone harvested, I believe, from his Facebook page of him giving this, you know, little gang sign with his gold tooth. You know, to me, that's irrelevant. You know, it truly is, because, you know, who knows? This kid could have graduated from high school. Everybody's trying to make it an issue of, oh, he got kicked out of school because the little marijuana bag that had traces of marijuana on it that they found in it. That's irrelevant. You know, this kid could have graduated from high school, went on to college. I mean, as far as we know, he could have been our next great president. You know, he could have been a scientist, you know. I mean, all that is irrelevant. You know, the problem I think we need to concentrate, like you said, is how do we help each other pick ourselves up as a society and move forward, whether that's job creations, whether that's...
I think the caller has made a great point. But all he really did was explain the polarization. How do we fix the polarization?
Do you have 5 weeks for the show? one of the things that gets lost in all this, because it started after the Civil War, is the big contest between all minorities is over jobs. And it's not just among African Americans. When the Italian immigrants moved here, they experienced the same thing. They were looking for jobs that other members of other races and groups look at. And when after the Civil War, when African Americans moved north to the north, they experienced problems because the people there, particularly ones who fought in the war, felt that they were going to take their jobs. And invariably, what happens is race becomes an issue when you're competing with someone for a job, because it's just another way to exclude somebody, and that ultimately becomes the issue. And exclusion of people in terms of getting a better job placement is a problem that we have to face in our country, the method in which we hire and fire.
Peter, do you have any thoughts on that one?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. I would take it to even broader extension. To me, it's just it's an unfortunate aspect of all life on this planet that the greater populations become, the more diverse they become, the more resources become scarce of all kinds, the more conflict there emerges. And I don't know of any way to fix it. I think part of it is talking about it and addressing it. At least that's a first step. But, these are just inherent problems that go back as long as life on this planet. And, it's a shame, but it seems at this point to be somewhat of an unavoidable fact of life right now. People of difference, of any kind of difference, view each other that way, and people see competition for all kinds of things every day in every way, and people set up walls and barriers between themselves, and I don't even know how to begin to start tearing those down, other than at least beginning to talk about it.
Right. I think talking about it is definitely a good start. John, you must have some thoughts.
Not cogent, however.
Oh, you can share them with us. I'm sure they're going to be controversial.
Yeah.
No one's
listening. I mean,
was just getting rapt by Manny's scintillating commentary. I think as far as improving the situation, you have to start with the young, the school system, and give these kids an opportunity to better themselves. That starts with the school system to me, and the family, of course. But I wanted to ask Manny and Peter, the gentleman mentioned the firearm, the earlier caller. In California, we have what's called a preclusion law or rule. Case law is that even if somebody is illegally carrying a firearm and he uses it in self-defense and kills the person, you can't factor in the fact that he's committed a crime to protect himself. And the person can only be charged with the misdemeanors of carrying a concealed and loaded firearm, but not with murder based on the fact that he illegally possessed this firearm. So we kind of have the same thing in this state. Whether he was carrying the gun legally or not, if he used it in self-defense, he's precluded from being charged for murder just based on that. Is that right, Manny and Peter?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, to my mind, it seems to me that's the way we want the law to work. We want to punish the person solely for whatever their crime or wrong is. And if they have if they're improperly carrying a gun, that carries some
crimes,
separate
an
offense.
This is not one of them.
But the issue of whether or not they conducted themselves properly in self-defense is in a completely separate issue. And so that makes sense to me, and that's the way I personally would like I would want the law to be.
But I haven't even heard this addressed. Whether or not he was legally carrying it or not, like this gentleman implied that Florida hadn't done their due diligence in granting him a permit, he could have even known someone out of the apartment. Who knows? Manny, you know how the small towns work down there.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm saying it's kind of irrelevant if he's justified using force and defending himself.
No, not if he's the first aggressor.
Well, that's not defense then, Simon.
Right. But isn't that the...
I was just addressing whether or not he should be carrying a firearm.
Yeah, and that's a very, very basic point. I agree. But and that is the point. And by the way, as you well know, giving guards firearms, particularly in California, is a scary subject because you just don't know what some of these guys are going to do.
Some cops, too.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one, too, John, you know, based upon your experiences, too. But
for self-defense, to use deadly force, you have to be in fear for your life.
Right.
And from what I've heard, it does appear Zimmerman was. He had injuries on the back of his head, grass stains on his back. He fired one shot, and it happened to be fatal. But you could make a prima facie case for self-defense just based on that alone.
Yeah, well, assuming that's true, and that's why I haven't commented on it, because like everyone else, I'd like to know what really happened before I start condemning anyone. And so we don't know what's happened. But what bothers me about this and what I don't agree with you is we have someone initiating this conduct, and you cannot allow people...
What conduct? Manny, calling the police that there's a suspicious person in your area?
Well, John, imagine this person is an employee of yours on one of the estates that you've worked on, you know, for me,
By the way, thanks for getting me those jobs.
Don't have to thank me publicly. The bottom line to all of it is, how would you react as this person's employer if he had conducted those acts while he was working for you? And I think, personally, you would be very distressed and very upset about it. That wouldn't be your instructions, nor would you want one of your employees to do something like that.
But I really don't know what he did.
Well, I'm saying based upon what you just said to me, not what he did or didn't do.
Wouldn't want him to engage the individual if that's what he did. But calling it in, that's his job.
No, that's what I'm saying. But you would not want him to engage the individual because of the dangers, both in terms of you possibly being sued by what ultimately came down. Because if you're his employer right now, you'd be concerned about the civil action, wouldn't you?
Big time.
So based upon that, you would not be in a rush to ever suggest to any of your employees that they take any action similar to what we're talking about here today, right?
And when I used to work on the desk at the police station or sheriff's station, I would never advise someone to follow a suspicious person because of liability. If something were to happen to that person, I would probably lose my job and the department would be sued. So you're always going to err on the side of caution, but that's not an order. It's a suggestion or a directive.
Okay. In this particular case, and I'm working only on rumor here, more than fact, but it's rumored.
Spoken like a true journalist, Simon.
It's rumored that Trayvon Martin was shot in the chest. Now,
right, I saw that.
Yeah, if these two are, you know, wrestling around on the ground, I just have a little issue with that bit.
Just a little one.
Why is that?
So you see it as difficult if you're face-to-face wrestling with someone to shoot them in the chest. And if that's indeed the facts, there will probably be an argument on the other side that one of the things they were wrestling over was the gun itself. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know enough about the subject matter to it. But when people get tangled up, almost anything is possible. But we're going to have to wait for that forensic evidence to come out or at least find out more about it.
Oh, I'm not doubting the facts or the rumor.
But your point is a good one.
I'm just pointing out that it doesn't seem like the obvious one.
No, another issue that I have here is, you know, Manny, you talked earlier about how you represented a lot of security guard companies, and I've done a lot of that representation as well. And, you know, the mandate for security guards was always the same, observe and report, avoid altercations or getting involved at all costs. Having said that, we both know that there were some security guards that just took it upon themselves to get involved no matter what. And I really don't know what capacity Mr. Zimmerman was acting in that night, if he's a security guard plus, or if he's something beyond that.
He was just a volunteer.
That. Yeah, a volunteer for a community watch, and I guess they had no real directives or guidelines about how they should conduct themselves.
Probably not.
Yeah, and that's probably going to be a subject of the civil suit when that starts to unfold.
Well, Peter, let me ask you this. We had one of the companies I represented, which was purchased by Wells Fargo, basically had about 9,000 guards. I don't think I ever had a time when I had less than 40 active defense cases involving their conduct. As fast as I got rid of a case, there'd be one right behind it. And it was like a never-ending source. I used to laugh about it because naturally they were providing me a nice income. But at the same time, there was a certain amount of wackiness to all these guys that got themselves involved. And I rarely saw some innocent guard suddenly get himself in a situation somewhat like this. And the ones that did were the guys who I would say to my client, why are you hiring this guy? Jesus. And, well, you know, one of them would say to me, well, we go through periods where we can't find enough guards and we have to compromise. And I go, oh, my God, there's compromise and then there's this. So
yeah.
It'd be a guy who could not have qualified to pass the test to work for any legitimate guard company. And from what I see of his conduct, people like John Perry would fire them immediately because they were too big of a risk. So if you label this guy as that big of a risk, then you look at his conduct, and even though in the case of carrying a firearm, as John clearly stated the law in California, there has to be some discussion about guys who are running willy-nilly around who want to be cops and instead engage in some form of this type of activity because they are cop wannabes.
Yeah,
and I think that we have to look at that very, very closely.
I think it's good. I think where that will come into is the belief that the person has that they're under some kind of physical threat is will take into consideration everything that affects their mental state. And if someone has a background or an issue that makes it seem like they're more likely to pull the trigger, that will cut against the theory that they objectively made a detached, reasonable assessment as to the risk here. And they, you know, I think it'll come in that way. And I think it's a very valid point. And I think there's no doubt that, you know, we have someone who has a predisposition towards that.
You know, Peter, that was one of the reasons when I listened to the charge of second degree murder, I immediately went to that and said, that may well be one of the reasons why she chose to take that particular action, is because it does raise the specter that this guy was predisposed in his pseudo cop-like mentality to take some action like this, because that's just who he is. And if that's the case, and like your example of going out, driving, speeding, and looking for a place for all this to go on, and suddenly somebody dies because of it, if that's second-degree murder, then under your example, this well too could be considered second-degree murder. John,
well,
do you agree with that? John?
Oh, Manny, in good conscience and based entirely on principle, I disagree with everything you said.
Good. Usually you don't have a reason.
Well, I was just thinking, you're going to have oddballs in every vocation, and I was thinking, you spoke about the Pacers earlier, you must have lost a lot of sleep when World Peace was on the team.
Well, I lost a lot of sleep reading his psychological reports, frankly.
You're always going to have guys like that, but how can you speak to their state of mind, especially if they might be a little off to begin with?
Well, you know, speaking of the state of mind of a basketball player is quite a bit different than speaking of the state of mind of someone after they've committed a crime like that. But then again, I guess we can all say that Meta World Peace committed a crime, the malice in the palace. So,
what about Olden Polonies? He was arrested for impersonating a police officer.
Yeah, well, but he didn't kill anybody. That's the bottom line. What separates this from everything else is somebody's dead. That's the point of all this. Somebody died during this. And you know, it reminded me of a old TV show in the movie. You know, Joseph Wambaugh wrote for his show, The Police Story. Joseph Wambaugh, for anyone who doesn't know, was an L.A. PD police officer who wrote a number of best-selling books, The New Centurions among them. And he wrote extensively and fostered the Emmy-winning TV show Police Story. And so to make a long story short, he did a whole show about this bank robber who was actually very funny and likable, and the police who were chasing him actually kind of liked the guy and didn't quite care what he did. They thought it was kind of funny. And then in one of the final scenes, his bank robbery kind of goes awry, and the net result is somebody died, and it suddenly went from no longer being a joke to being a capital crime. And so when you got a guy out in the streets like this, and he's wandering around doing all these things, and it may sound a little funny and whatever, but sooner or later, someone's going to die. And the question with him is, was that really what happened in this particular case? Is sooner or later, with Zimmerman on the streets, was somebody going to die because of him? I don't know, but that you have to think about that, don't you?
That's quite a leap, Manny.
Why, thank you, Chad.
Okay. Let's talk about the future for a second. There's a bail hearing set on Friday. Zimmerman's latest defense team, and we'll talk about the old defense team in a minute, but his new defense team are looking for bail on own recognizance. What's the chances of that happening?
Well, I think there's a chance on my side because one of the issues that no one really talks about is he's made no effort to take flight, which will get you back to your comments about his former lawyers, and either quite capable of putting an ankle bracelet on him or somewhere else, or limit his activities in such a way that he would be available. And I think what they should do, because I agree with O'Mara that he needs him to prepare his case. So in all fairness, to give him an opportunity to represent himself in this action, that they should consider doing that.
Peter, would you agree with Manny?
Well, yeah, basically, yes. The biggest concern I have for him is his safety. I don't particularly think he's a flight risk, although it did trouble me that apparently he went off radar from his attorneys for a while, and they took it upon themselves to tell the world that they thought he had left the state, which I don't think was a great service to their client. But I think there's a safety issue. But on the whole, I think that, you know, his request for, you know, being released on bail will be considered fairly. I can't say for certain how it's going to come down, but I agree with what Manny said.
Okay, but they're asking for bail for nothing. Do you think any judge is going to grant that?
You know, I really don't know what his resources are, but probably not. He'll have to find some way to post some amount of bail. You know, I think that one thing that's really affecting all of the hearings in this matter is the political perception, the social perception, that he'll get any kind of favoritism. So I think they're going to try as hard as they can to treat him just like anybody else, even though it's not going to be like anyone else.
You see, this is probably where I disagree, because I'm not a lawyer, and I don't deal in fairness and the law. My law is the law of the land, and this case has got such huge amounts of publicity. There is no way they're going to grant him bail on his own recognizance. I'd be, frankly, incredibly surprised if bail was set at less than $100,000.
One of the things I found, Simon, over a period of time is bail oftentimes is related to the beliefs of a judge, particularly how he perceives an individual case. If this judge has a feeling or that he has somehow been overcharged, and he may be a devotee and a supporter of the of this law, then he will likely be more lenient on bail than another judge. So it'll depend on the political leanings of the individual judge.
Ah, well, you've brought up an incredibly interesting subject. The judge involved is Jessica Rexidler. I'm sure I butchered her name there. Yeah, she's only been on the bench for, I think, 16 months. And she is already begging to be let off the case. There's a conflict of interest, and it involves her husband. Hubby works for or works with none other than our very good friend Mark Najem. And of course, Najem is well known on CNN. Yeah, he's one of their favorite contributors, legal analyst on this particular case. So, I can see an ugly situation.
What's ugly? This is standard in the legal business. Prosecutors and judges get married all the time, and it's a problem that just is in the industry. You just have to deal with it.
I'm glad she disclosed it.
Yeah, sometimes they don't bother. But you,
yeah.
It's really hide to hide the hide you who your spouse is, you know what I mean? And so usually everybody pretty well knows that this is an issue, and certainly this prosecutor has to know the relationship. Do they want to change it? It depends on her views. I think it has more to do with whether they think she's liberal or good for them or they can win or lose a case in front of them than it is any concept of a conflict of interest. Do you disagree, Peter?
No, I agree with that. I think these concepts are usually, they seem much more dramatic when we focus on them in isolation. But the simple fact of the matter is that the legal community is like every community. There's lots of interaction. There's lots of people who know people. There are lots of people who marry others in the industry. And you hear these kinds of disclosures all the time. It troubles me more when you don't hear them than when I do. And I don't think that this in and of itself is sufficient to disqualify her, but, you know, we'll see how the parties react to this information.
Yeah, and I agree with Simon. I got a sense of her that she was hoping she would get dinged.
Yeah, well, the judges wouldn't want anything to do with this, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually view that as a credit to her. I mean, I'm always concerned when you get a judge who wants the publicity. That, to me, is the real troubling sign. I have a lot of respect for a judge who says, I really don't want to deal with all of this. They're probably a better judge. You know, the only times I see judges who really want to get in front of the camera, it really gives me a bad feeling.
Yeah, me too. I really don't like that at all. And, yes, I agree with you. And usually when someone withholds that fact, there's a certain element of them wanting to be on the case because they have an agenda or they like the idea. They want their children to see their names in the paper, whatever it is. So, John, have you had any experience with that throughout your career?
Well, I'm just reminded of the most obvious. Lance Ito was married to an LAPD captain, and he turned out to be adverse to the prosecution, so you can never really tell.
Did you think he was adverse to prosecution? I just thought he was a miserably bad judge.
Absolutely.
And considering I played poker with him a few times, but, you know, I had other feelings about it, too.
What judge would want to even get involved in this, because that ruined Ito's career.
Well, you know, Ito has no one to blame for himself. One of the things that was not disclosed in the Simpson case is Ito once shared an office with all these various prosecutors, including Johnny Cochran. They'd known each other forever. They were close friends. And he basically was, I think, too tolerant of his friends, and the judge who wasn't in some way related to all these guys in some way would have handled the Simpson case, I think, far better and far differently than the way he did. And I think
he never considered conflicting out because of his relationship with his wife. That's my point. And I think most judges realize, regardless of the outcome of this trial, a lot of people are going to be upset, and it's a no-win situation for them.
Absolutely. That's why Peter so aptly points out that the biggest concern is when judges don't disqualify themselves because it means they have an agenda.
Right. Absolutely. They're going to capitalize this on this one way or the other, and it's not going to be advancement in their legal career.
No, because invariably I agree with you that generally you have more problems than you have good things with these cases, and I think they end up, as you point out also, not good for an individual judge's reputation in the long run because he can't please anybody.
Right.
Do you feel that way too, Peter?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole thing just reminds me of a couple major themes that all of this and all the matters that we've talked about are always come back to. You know, I think Simon said it earlier, everything is politics, and that's because people are inherently political, whether you have them in small groups or big groups. We all have agendas and points of view, and in today's world, it seems like, you know, the prospect of being on the media and being broadcast and having your name, your face, your words, your statements promulgated everywhere is very alluring for everyone. And every time you have a case like this, there's always this rush of everyone and everything around it that wants to be involved in one way or another. And the person you really hope doesn't have that particular point of view is the judge, because they're the ones we're really counting on to try and keep this from becoming a circus. So, you know, we've seen judges who love to be there in the center of the limelight, and I'm reassured when I find one who doesn't really want that. That's my gut tells me that's probably the one we want, but I still don't know enough about it.
So, Simon, I'm sure the clock is ticking when I take a look at there, and we're about to go off the air whether we want to or not. So
right,
we have to take a moment.
Fear not. We're going to lose the live listeners, but it's all being recorded. I do need to close the program down, but there's one last little area that I want to touch on. That really bizarre press conference early last week by Zimmerman's ex-counsel. 46 minutes to explain that they were unable to get hold of their client. He wasn't in Florida anymore. I mean, this cannot possibly help Zimmerman's case.
Well, I don't agree with you. I think that any rational judge or anyone was repelled by what they saw, and they did more harm to themselves than they did to Zimmerman, because if anything, I would be sympathetic towards Zimmerman after that show of stupidity. I don't know about the others. And Peter, I think, earlier mentioned that he was equally appalled by what he saw. You still feel that way, Peter?
I just don't like, I mean, unfortunately, one of the things I see all too often is that lawyers are drawn to these cases by the allure of the publicity. And, you know, I'm certainly as guilty of it as anyone else, but it's something you have to be mindful of. You have to try to do your job, and you have to try to not play to the cameras. And this press conference just seemed a bit more like the attorneys playing to the cameras than it did doing their jobs. And I thought the exact same thing years ago when I saw Simpson's former defense lawyers get up there and go on the press and talk about how their client had just flown, and they started reading a suicide note that he had supposedly written. And I had the same reaction then that I do now. Why are they disclosing so much information about their client's situation? And I can't help but think that it's this desire to want to get in front of the camera and explain things. I really hate to see it, but it's part of the unavoidable consequence of all this stuff.
One of the things that bothered me was the ethics behind it.
Or lack thereof.
Right, or lack thereof. I mean, it just didn't seem very ethical. I mean, you know, it's one thing to put out a press release saying, we are no longer representing George Zimmerman, period. But it's a whole new ball game to explain, we haven't been able to get in touch with him, blah, blah, blah. No, we've never actually met him. Yeah, we've talked to him by phone and email. To me, I was wide-eyed at this.
Well, the general rule is you're not supposed to reveal information that you gather from your client in the act of communicating with him or her about the representation. Unfortunately, it's a rule that people can narrowly or broadly interpret as they deem fit, and there's very little in the way of enforcement for it. And to say that you haven't had any communication with your client by email, there are lots of lawyers who will say, well, I'm not revealing anything in the attorney-client communication privilege because I haven't been able to communicate from. I don't agree with that, but I think that's the way of looking at it. I think, again, the bigger picture is part of the incentive for a lot of these lawyers to take these cases is to get publicity. And if a press calls you up and says, well, I understand you're withdrawing from the case, can you tell us why? And you say, we've put the reasons for the fact that we're withdrawing in our papers and we really can't say anything else. You don't get any more phone calls. Nobody wants to talk to you. You're not important anymore. And I think that's one of the battles that goes on with these kinds of things.
Yeah. In fact, I joke, I've represented over a period of years a lot of celebrity clients, and I joke with them every time. I've been at, you know, out at cocktails and the news on the background with some lawyer doing exactly as you described, and I look at it, and I'll look at it, and I'll joke with my clients, so how would you feel if that were me on TV? And I want to tell you, the look on their face said it all. I mean, they would just look at me like, oh, my God, I'm just appalled. So I can't imagine how Zimmerman felt when he turned on the TV and saw this, what I would describe as insult to injury. I mean, it had to be horrible for him.
The worst part is I think that people, you know, if you're in the market for criminal defense services, sadly, many people will see the fact that these guys were on TV talking about this, and they won't know any better, and they'll say, well, these guys are famous. These guys are on TV. These guys talk about it. These are the guys I should hire.
Yep, well, that's exactly what motivated them, their belief that that's what governs people.
That's right. That's right.
And okay, we have to wrap this program up. I want to thank everyone, and I just want to go quickly round the table to get everyone's final thoughts. John, I'm going to start with you.
Well, thanks for having me on today, Simon. Always entertaining. And one final thought regarding the attorneys. I felt they threw their client under the bus, but F. Lee Bailey made a pretty good livelihood of doing much the same.
Manny.
My position about this simple is we're arguing a set of possible facts, and within 3 or 4 weeks we'll be back here again, and we're going to bring Peter back, and then we're going to start discussing what the real facts are, and then probably in 6 or 8 weeks as some more trickle out, we'll probably get together and discuss what those real facts are. So the moral of this to our listeners is don't buy into what you hear. There's much, much more to come. None of us know what that is. So be prepared for changes in evidence as quick as the Internet can publish them. And for that reason alone, this case is going to go in a terrible direction where the public discussion of this is going to be more important than the case itself. And I feel sad for Zimmerman, right or wrong, that he is going to become a victim of public opinion.
Mm-hmm. And Peter?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank everybody for having me on. I really love talking about these topics with everyone, and I want to thank everyone for giving me thoughts and ideas that I'd never had before, which I desperately need. And I really can't do anything else other than just confirm what everyone else has said. I really look forward to seeing the truth, whatever that may be, unfold, and I know that there's a big difference between the court of law and the court of public opinion, and there are very different rules and procedures and guidelines on evidence that apply to both. I look forward to seeing how the facts unfold at trial, and I look forward to seeing how they're perceived by the court of public opinion, which is the largest court in the land, ultimately.
Good point.
Gentlemen, I really want to thank you sincerely for taking part today. I think we've covered a huge amount of ground. Let's do it again soon.
All right, thanks, Simon. Take care.
Yeah,
thank you.
My pleasure. Till next week, this is Simon Barrett and Manny Barling wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. We'll be back again next Sunday.